Grain is once again moving out of Ukrainian ports along the Black Sea. It's just taking a while to get past the inspectors.
More than 1 month, the vessels are waiting.
Ukraine says Russia is playing games, delaying dozens of its ships filled with food. Also today, the Taliban's continued crackdown against women. A former member of Afghanistan's parliament is shot and killed in her home. Her colleague says life there has become unbearable for women.
If you live and you're not regarded as a human being, you're literally dying in slow motion.
And we remember a pioneer of electronic music, Yukihiro Takahashi and Yellow Magic Orchestra, delighted and bewildered audiences in the 1980s.
In case you folks out there in television land are wondering what's going on, I haven't the slightest idea.
I'm Marco Werman. That's all ahead today on The World. Thank you for being here today. An insider from a Russian mercenary group has forced his way out. That's Andrei Medvedev, a commander in the Wagner Group, the private Russian military contractors. Medvedev is saying that Wagner extended his contract after it ended, even though he wanted to leave. He also says the Wagner mercenaries execute deserters. Not seeing many options, he made a run for it. He was speaking with a Russian human rights organization called Gulag.net. Pierre Vaux keeps tabs on the Wagner Group and is an investigator with the Center for Information Resilience in London. Pierre, what do we know about the circumstances of Andrei Medvedev's harrowing escape?
Well, so far, there's only really a couple of sources on his escape. So the Norwegian authorities said that his detention was undramatic, in their own words, although they arrested him in the forest after he'd already entered the country. In an interview with Gulagu.net, which is run by Vladimir Osiechin, he said that he'd traveled to Murmansk and then headed to a small border town of Nikel, which is about 1 mile from the Norwegian border. He dressed in a white dressing gown to camouflage himself from the snow and had to set off on foot. He claims that he was pursued. He saw headlights. He heard dogs chasing him. Shots were fired at him. And then in order to cross the border, he had to climb over a barbed wire fence and then run across a frozen river. So that's, we've only got that so far from his own accounts of it. But it's not necessarily surprising because we know that border is quite militarized.
That's pretty dramatic stuff. Do you know where Medvedev is now?
He is in Oslo, as far as I'm aware, at a detention center.
A detention center. Why is he detained?
Yeah, he is seeking asylum. It's the detention for anyone who's made illegal border crossings into Norway. So he is being processed as per normal by the Norwegian authorities. Mm.
So what sort of information has he been able to share about the Wagner Group so far?
He says that he signed a contract in June last year for 4 months. He said that of his platoon of 30 men, so he was a commander of a squad of 15 within a platoon of 30, only three were left after several days, because from August onwards, they started sending in recruited convicts, with a lot of them with very little military experience or training. And they're being used in human wave attacks, so with really high casualty rates. And that we can confirm, because we're seeing the footage that's coming out of Bakhmut and the area around that, and it's absolutely brutal fighting, with piles of corpses of Wagner fighters lying across fields. It's really harrowing combat there. It's important to bear in mind that we have to be wary of any testimony from defectors from Wagner, not necessarily because anything he said doesn't line up, but just because the Prigozhin organization, of which Wagner is part, is quite adept and frequently conducts disinformation operations in terms of seeding false reports.
And do the details of Medvedev's account match what you've seen reported about the Wagner Group?
In terms of the brutality of it, well, I mean, this is what's interesting, is Medvedev was, he claims, the commander in his squad of a guy called Yevgeny Nuzhin. Nuzhin was quite high profile because he was captured by Ukrainian forces and gave interview in a video released by the SBU, the Ukrainian Security Service. For some reason, he was then exchanged in a prisoner exchange a couple of months ago. And on his return to Russia, he was videoed being executed with a sledgehammer by Wagner. Which with the Yevgeny Prigozhin, who's the sort of patron of the Wagner Group, has now turned into a sort of a branding for the organization. So they sent a sledgehammer to the European Parliament to celebrate their own brutality.
How and why does Russia use the Wagner Group? Why doesn't the Kremlin have their official troops do the same work as Wagner?
The Wagner Group has been used for a lot of different purposes, and it's part of a broader organization. So it's got three big pillars to it: military, business, and influence. So for the military aspect, they're used as mercenaries, they're used as security services. They were also initially, in their very first appearance, was effectively as a death squad in Luhansk in eastern Ukraine, where they were actually used to wipe out pro-Russian separatist commanders who were troublesome for the local authorities there in the Russian-backed administration.
So the Wagner Group really kind of makes its first appearance public, if you will, in 2015 in Ukraine. Now, they recently captured the town of Soledar, the Wagner Group, which seems like the first win Russia has been able to notch up for a while. Why do you think the Kremlin would use Wagner Group for that and not their regular army?
Well, this is a point of contention. So Prigozhin and the Wagner Group are very keen on saying it was solely their forces that took Soledar. However, it was Russian airborne forces doing a lot of the fighting, VDV, paratroopers. So I think Prigozhin is lying and inflating the role of the Wagner Group. So they are really trying to produce a brand as a power within Russia.
Pierre Vaux is an investigator with the Center for Information Resilience in London, where he follows the dealings of the Russian military contractors, the Wagner Group. Pierre, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Russia's blockades of Ukrainian ports early in the war were aimed at hitting Ukraine's economy hard. They did. The blockades also led to a global food crisis. Shipments out of Black Sea ports have resumed, but Ukraine is now accusing Russia of purposely causing long inspection delays. The World's Daniel Hoffman has this story from the Ukrainian port city of Odessa.
The southern city of Odessa has always been known as an international city, its port a gateway to the rest of the world. Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Odessa's port and its global significance has come into focus.
Turning now to Ukraine, where Russia is bombarding Odessa with missiles.
According to the U.S., about two dozen Russian warships are off Odessa's coastline, blockading the strategic port home to Ukraine's navy.
President Zelensky warns of a global food crisis.
At the beginning of the war, after Russia targeted the port, shipping came to a halt.
The ports were blocked even before the 24th of February.
That's Dmytro Barinov. He's deputy head of Ukraine's Seaport Authority, which is responsible for all of Ukraine's ports. He says that even before the full-scale invasion, Russia began mining the area and conducting military exercises.
All ports were blocked. They bring the submarines, the navy ships, and Russia started to attack. All ports were under attack.
Ukrainian grain was stuck inside the country, and there were fears that the corn and wheat stored in silos would begin to rot. After months of negotiations, UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres announced that there was a deal.
Today, at last, we have a ray of hope. A ray of hope to ease human suffering and alleviate hunger around the world. A ray of hope to support developing countries and the most vulnerable people. A ray of hope to bring a measure of much-needed stability to the global food system.
Eventually, the deal was signed by the UN, Turkey, Russia, and Ukraine. One of the conditions of the deal was that all parties would be able to inspect the ships at a transit point in Turkey. In early August, the first cargo ship left the port of Odessa.
This vessel makes some whistle. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. And even people stop. And not the cry, but they were very expressive that the life keep going, so life continue.
Just days later, though, there was another Russian long-range missile strike on the Odessa port. Many believed that the deal could fall apart, but it held, and it was even extended. Now, Barinov says, Russia is creating delays during the inspection process at the Joint Coordination Center in Turkey.
Now we have more than 90 vessels
waiting on this queue. More than 1 month, the vessels are waiting, but they check it, and we can export a lot of, even in a 2.5 times more cargo, more grain, more agriculture product on the market. But Russia every day makes something again.
Bidenov says Russia is deliberately throwing wrenches into the process. Ismini Pala is a UN spokesperson for the Black Sea Grain Initiative. She says there have been vessels waiting for inspection for over a month, but she didn't lay blame on any of the delegations.
There are many factors that affect the timely inspection of the ship. We had numerous occasions where the joint teams had to go back to a vessel to conclude the inspection.
Pala says that sometimes vessels don't have the correct documents in place, or there could be difficult weather conditions or other safety concerns. But she also says that
sometimes there are different approaches taken by the delegations that may affect the timely inspection of the vessel.
According to Bidenov, Ukraine's exports are down threefold compared to last year, even with the grain deal still holding.
Do you believe in the stability of the current deal, or do you think it could fall apart?
I am optimist, but who knows? From the Russian side, it doesn't matter. They kill our kids, so why they not shoot to the vessel or to the port?
So far, according to Bidenov, about 17 million tons of cargo has been exported as a result of the grain deal. The deal is set to expire in mid-March. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Odessa, Ukraine.
This track came out in 1979 when these sounds were as remote to most ears as a computer game the song was mimicking. This tune is in fact called Computer Game by Japan's Yellow Magic Orchestra. Yukihiro Takahashi was one of the co-founders of YMO, as they're known, and a pioneer of electronic music in the 80s. He died last week, leaving behind a sonic legacy that many of us may not recognize, especially in a world where computers, synthesizers, and autotune now feel like natural parts of the music technology landscape. YMO's impact at the time took them all the way to Now, this was in 1980 when disco, funk, and soul started incorporating elements of electronica, and the Soul Train audience dug what they heard. Host Don Cornelius was both impressed and a little bewildered.
In case you folks out there in television land are wondering what's going on, I haven't the slightest idea.
But in conversation with Takahashi, Cornelius did get to the essence of YMO's music.
Which of the current sounds do you think Yellow Magic Orchestra is close to?
It's difficult. Like a Kraftwerk. Do you know Kraftwerk?
Of course. Hey, this is Big Don here, brother.
For those who don't know Kraftwerk, they're a German band formed in 1970, widely considered the pioneers of electronic pop. Yukihiro Takahashi and Yellow Magic Orchestra were learning from Kraftwerk along with disco, soul, and new wave, pulling all those strings together in a way that netted listeners across the globe.
In the year 1980 alone, they've earned 4 platinum records as a together gang for the Yellow Magic Orchestra.
Yukihiro Takahashi died last week at the age of 70. Ahead on the show, Mirsal Nabizadeh could have fled Afghanistan with a humanitarian visa, but the women's rights activist and former lawmaker remained in Kabul. This weekend, gunmen killed Nabizadeh in her home. Just ahead, a look at her legacy and what her death tells us about Afghanistan a year and a half after the Taliban regained control. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. More than a year after taking power in Afghanistan, the Taliban continue their brutal drive to erase women from public life. Among their latest efforts, barring women from working in national and international non-governmental organizations, NGOs. In response to that decision last month, several major international aid agencies, including the Norwegian Refugee Council, suspended their operations. Jan Egeland, the head of the NRC, recently returned from Kabul. He told us that when he was in Afghanistan, he and the group's female employees had some difficult conversations. They were left reeling by the Taliban's actions.
They said first they took education from our daughters, then they prohibited us to go to parks even, and now they take our work. They're crushing our future.
Eglen said he promised the women in Afghanistan that the NRC would not work with men only.
I said the same to the Taliban ministers. We cannot and we will not work with men only and give aid to males only in Afghanistan.
Eglen said the Taliban ministers he sat down with in Kabul told him the ban on women working with NGOs came from a single person, the Taliban supreme leader in Kandahar. Still, Eglen says he has not given up on the idea that the Taliban decision could be reversed.
And at the moment, we're seeing some glimmers of hope. There seems to be an opportunity to do health work with women and men equally, to do primary education work with male and female teachers, male and female administrators. And when we have assurances in writing and security for our female staff, we will resume work.
Re-establishing those connections will be critical. The United Nations estimates that more than 28 million Afghans, more than 70% of the population, require humanitarian assistance. Eglen said he's also worried that the Taliban may limit the exceptions to the ban on women working with NGOs, that it might only be lifted in particular parts of the country. He warned that many people will suffer because of this and the repeated false promises of reform coming from the Taliban.
They misled us because they told us there would be education, there would be work for women and girls. It's really a blow to the gut of us as humanitarian organizations, but also to the people of Afghanistan. In the middle of winter, people are freezing, people are starving. It's terrible, and the needs are not being met.
Even the most powerful women in Afghanistan fear for their lives, and for good reason. This weekend, a former legislator was shot and killed in her home in Kabul, along with her bodyguard. Mirsal Nabizadeh was one of the few women who served in parliament and decided to remain in the country after the Taliban took power in August of 2021. Fawzia Koofi served with Nabizadeh in Afghanistan's parliament. They were friends as well as colleagues. Fawzia Koofi joins us from London. Ms. Koofi, first of all, our condolences to you.
Thank you. These are hard days for everyone in Afghanistan.
Well, I'd like to hear from you as a friend and colleague of Mirsal Nabizadeh, just more about her. What sort of person was she?
She was young when she ran for parliament in 2018, and she was very passionate about her country and about her work. She was very ambitious. She wanted to serve the communities and be connected with the communities. And this was one of the reasons that despite all the risks, she chose to stay in Afghanistan.
Were you two in touch in recent months?
Yeah, she recently texted me after the Taliban ban on women working with NGOs and the UN, requesting to see if there are possibilities for her to leave the country. She was working with an NGO, and after the ban, it was not possible. So her message was that it's getting too much. I want to leave now. So, yeah.
Did she express worries about her own safety, about living in Afghanistan with the Taliban in charge?
Not about her safety. Everyone in Afghanistan is unsafe. Women are more unsafe because of their work and because of the fact the Taliban don't like them, even if they are a female student or female teacher or female leader. They don't like them. So every woman in Afghanistan is unsafe. She was more worried about her dreams that were shattered and her work that was no longer possible. And like many other who are in contact with me, they tell me that they know they might not survive the day that they start. Every Afghan woman now that they contact me, they tell me that for them is dead in slow motion. Because if you live and you're not regarded as a human being, you're literally dying in slow motion.
So I understand that Mirsal Nabizadeh was offered a humanitarian visa and could have left the country long ago after the Taliban took over in 2021. She did not, though. I'm just wondering if you have any insight into her decision to stay.
Well, I think initially she tend to believe the Taliban's promise in terms of supporting women's rights. So like many others who actually were trapped into this narrative Taliban created, which was Taliban 2.0, pro-woman, etc. Mm-hmm. So I think she wanted to give a chance. But in reality, This is a narrative that Taliban created, and we and our international friends tend to believe it. It was a failed and false narrative.
Fawzia, you yourself survived at least two assassination attempts, so you're well aware of the dangers in Afghanistan, especially what women face. Given what you call the failed and false narrative of Taliban 2.0, what are you saying to other women you speak with who are still in Afghanistan?
Well, I feel very bad for not being able to be with them. But I know that even if I was in Afghanistan, I wasn't able to do much because I was already under house arrest when Taliban came and I didn't want to leave. So I don't have words when they text me messages or voice messages full of pain and sorrows and emotions asking me to help them leave the country, especially after the Taliban two recent ban on women from university and banning women from NGOs. I think literally that was like the last nail in women's rights coffin. So everyone wants to leave. And there are some who are more at risk, especially my female colleagues, politicians who are in Afghanistan. Some of them are in Pakistan and Iran, and they are desperate. Like they are asking me to support them. So one of Marcella's colleagues texted me the day before yesterday, the same day that she was killed, and said, "Ms. Kofi, is there a way for me to get out? Who knows? Probably the next would be me." But the fact is that we can't get 35 million people out, right? So we need to really look at beyond humanitarian aid and humanitarian visa and see how politically we can create an alternative for Taliban so that Taliban are stopped and they do not last very long. And finally, they agree for a political settlement.
So because of that move by the Taliban banning women from working for NGOs, some aid groups have quit their operations in Afghanistan, which, of course, has its own counterproductive consequences. What do you think humanitarian groups should do when it comes to dealing with the Taliban?
I think it was the right decision to close some of these humanitarian aid, because how come your taxpayers' money go to a group excluding women from the offices? It was difficult for these humanitarian organizations to reach women across Afghanistan as in terms of the recipients. So I think it was a good decision. As much as it's difficult and challenging, and I know that economically people are suffering, but I think it was the right decision to do so.
Ms. Kofi, is there a memory about Mirsal Nabizadeh that you've been holding on to in recent days that you'll keep with you moving forward?
Yeah, when she was elected in 2018, she actually contacted me and she said, "I would like you to mentor me." And it was very sweet when you hear that from somebody. It indicated the legacy, but also, you know, her passion to really be meaningfully involved in politics and try to do things for our country.
Fawzia Kofi is a former member of Afghanistan's parliament. She joined us from London. Again, our condolences and thank you very much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you.
More news from around the globe still ahead for you this hour. You're listening to The World. The size of the world's most populous country is shrinking. China's one-child policy slowed things down. Now Beijing is grappling with the opposite problem from decades past.
It's that we're going to have to make a lot of efforts to incentivize young couples to have even one child, much less two or three.
But it may be too late for that to happen. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Brazil's new president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, took office this month. At the top of his agenda, restoring the Amazon. Lula has promised to stop deforestation and roll back illegal mining. Mining is big business in the Amazon. It grew a lot under Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro. This next story on the show is part two in a series looking at the future of the Amazon. Today, Michael Fox reports from Brazil's rainforest on the battle over a new gold mine project that a Canadian firm is hoping to launch.
Clayson Juruna stands at the edge of the Xingu River, staring out over the water. He's tall, short hair, dark skin. He's the young chief of the Juruna people. They've lived here in the Amazonian state of Pará for generations. The Xingu River is our life, he says. She's our mother, our arms and legs. It's our means of transportation and our food. But in recent years, times have been hard. In 2016, a new hydroelectric dam began to wreak havoc on the river, decreasing water levels by 80% and killing tons of fish, a major source of food for Clayson and his people. Now, the Juruna face yet another threat. Just upstream from their territory, the Canadian mining company Belo Sun hopes to open the largest open-pit gold mine in the Amazon. The company says the location contains almost 4 million ounces of gold, worth more than $8 billion. Belosan General Manager Rodrigo Costa told me in an email that the operation would promote sustainable development by providing 7,000 jobs, tax revenue, infrastructure, and socio-environmental projects. But Clayson Juruna says the mine would be a disaster. Belosan is here to practically end the lives of the native peoples who live here, the Juruna and the Arara, he says. He points at a map of the region. Roughly 6 miles divide the location of the planned mine from Pakisama indigenous land, where Clayson and his people live. In the middle is the Xingu River. If there were any type of tragedy, he says, any leak of something toxic, it would contaminate the entire region, the communities and indigenous territories, ours and others downstream. Belosan says the mine was designed to have zero environmental impact. General Manager Rodrigo Costa wrote me that, quote, there will be no discharge of effluents into the environment, which is an industrial practice in organized and responsible gold mining. But environmental and indigenous activists are not taking chances. In December, the NGO Amazon Watch released a report underscoring the dangers of the project. It accused Belosan executives of spreading misleading information and downplaying risks. Indigenous leaders protested against the mine at a biodiversity conference in Montreal last month. People need to understand that this mine will not just impact the state of Pará and the indigenous peoples. It will impact the world, said indigenous leader Puyer Tembe at the conference. You will feel the impact. Humanity needs to wake up. But not all community members are against the mine. In this 2017 video from Belosan's Facebook page, residents of the town of Hesaca, near the mine site, rally in favor of the project. We have miners, farmers, and fishermen who depend on development, says a man in a white cowboy hat. Behind him, someone holds a sign reading, Make Our Opinion Count. Belosan officials say local communities approve the project in a series of local consultation processes held over the last decade. But indigenous and environmental activists say those meetings were flawed, residents pressured, and local indigenous communities never gave the green light for the project. Mining in the Amazon comes in the form of both large-scale projects like Belosan's Volta Grande mine and from illegal wildcat miners that have pushed onto indigenous territories in recent years. Brazil's new president Lula has called for sustainability and vowed to end wildcat mining. Vamos acabar com qualquer possibilidade de garimpo ilegal. We're going to stop any possibility of illegal mining. We need more than just a law. It needs to be a declaration of faith, Lula said on the campaign trail. But Lula's relationship with legal mining in the Amazon will likely be more complicated. Some operations are deeply rooted. The largest iron ore mine in the world, for instance, has been located in the southern Amazon for half a century. Hundreds of companies have mining applications pending across the Brazilian Amazon. Gisele Costa is a professor at Amazonas Federal University who specializes on the impacts of mining in the region. This mining might be legal in that there is a supposed consultation process and such, says Costa, but the extraction of that ore will still pollute the rivers, kill people, and so on. Belosan is awaiting a pair of licenses for the mine to proceed. They hope they can get the green light this year. Indigenous and environmental activists have vowed to do everything in their means to ensure that that approval never comes. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
Tomorrow, our series on the future of the Amazon continues as we look at the role of indigenous leadership and how it might be changing attitudes among lawmakers in the capital, Brasilia. After decades of incredible growth, China's population is now on the decline, and that has a lot of people there worried. They're concerned how the economic engine of the world's most populous country will keep churning along. To help us understand what's behind the drop and how it will affect China as well as Chinese families, we turn to our old friend Mary Kay Magstad. Mary Kay was a longtime China correspondent for The World and is now with the Asia Society Center on U.S.-China relations. So, Mary Kay, first things first, was this historic drop in population in China expected?
It was expected. It just wasn't expected to come this soon, in part because the government expected that when it lifted the one child policy restrictions back 6-7 years ago, that young women, young couples would be eager to have additional children. And that hasn't turned out to be the case.
Yeah. So for listeners who remember China's one child policy, remind us how that worked and to what degree that is the reason for the drop in China's population.
The one-child policy, which was implemented in the early 80s, was very harshly imposed. Quite often, there were severe penalties on women and on couples who had more than one child, like sometimes to the extent of tearing down someone's home or having them lose their job. And the idea was, we have a rapidly growing population. It's going to be too much for the country to handle. We need to crack down on this now, and this is the way we're going to do it. And there were 500,000 people in the apparatus that tried to make sure that families only had one child. The irony here is that it's been shown around the world that there's a natural drop off in fertility rates when women become more educated. Female education is one of the main factors that lead to fewer children. And that was already starting to happen in China before the one child policy was implemented. So there actually has been discussion within China among demographers and outside of China about, you know, what would have happened without the one-child policy? There was a strong preference in many Chinese families for boys. If you're going to have one child, you want a boy. So there were a lot of selective abortions over the course of the 80s and 90s. And then in certain provinces, there was a gender mismatch where there were, you know, as many as like 120 boys for every 100 girls. So we now have a population of a certain age, those who grew up during the one-child policy, where there aren't enough women for the men who might want to get married. So that also contributes to a drop in fertility overall for women. But in addition to that, you have educated women who see that they have other choices besides having a bunch of kids and who grew up in one-child families. And so for them, it's normal for people to only have one child or perhaps no children. And many of them are making that choice.
Mary Kay, what other reasons do you point to for why China's population is shrinking and so much sooner than expected?
Raising a child is very expensive in China. Education is not entirely free. Cities are very expensive. Real estate prices have gone up. And also, only children who, you know, were brought up where they had a lot of resources poured into them. They had a lot of choices and options that Chinese and previous generations didn't have, including international travel, but also more choice with the kinds of jobs they did and what they did with their leisure time. A lot of people just decided having kids isn't for me. And that is a choice that, you know, in previous generations was not really accepted. And in this generation is more accepted. So meanwhile, and this is also important demographically, China has a rapidly aging population. In fact, it's by some demographers' estimates, the elderly population will be larger than the working age population by 2080. And that's going to have an impact, a significant impact on economic growth and high labor costs. So this is a challenge that's going to face China going forward.
Based on what you know, Mary Kay, is there anything the Chinese government can do that will encourage people to have more kids? Or do you think that ship has sailed now?
Such a good question. The government has been trying, and it's kind of been interesting seeing the steps that they've taken along the way to recognize, oh, it's not that everyone's clamoring to have two or three or four children. It's that we're going to have to make a lot of efforts to incentivize young couples to have even one child, much less two or three. And demographics are a bitch. Like, if you are behind and you're seeing that, like, over the next couple of generations, you're going to have a specific population that's already been born. You have to deal with that reality, even as you're trying to encourage young people to have more kids. As a generation that has already been born comes into the age of being able to have their own children, if it's a smaller generation, there are probably going to be fewer children, unless everyone's incentivized through government programs that, like, maybe offer free education or, you know, other free incentives that otherwise wouldn't be on the table. And even then, you know, people have a wealth of different choices about how their lives are going to be. And they might not choose to have children, even if they're offered all these incentives. And that appears to be what's happening now. The government hasn't found the sort of secret sauce to be able to incentivize enough young people to have children.
Mary Kay Magstad is a former China correspondent for The World. She's now deputy director of the Asia Society Center on U.S.-China Relations. Mary Kay, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco.
South Africa is facing an energy crisis. Parts of the country have gone dark because of rolling blackouts, known there as load shedding. Public anger is directed at the state utility company and the ruling African National Congress Party. Lungile Mashile is in Johannesburg. She's an energy analyst and lecturer at the University of Johannesburg. Lungile, what is the latest there? How bad are the electricity cuts right now?
They are very bad at the moment, Marco. We're looking at about 8 to 10 hours of no electricity a day, and sometimes this can go up to 12 hours. We have variable blackouts or rotating blackouts known as load shedding, and they happen at various stages. So at the moment, we are rotating between stage 4, stage 5, and stage 6. So this means that the national utility calls for 4,000 megawatts demand reduction at stage 4. So all of these three stages are experienced within a 24-hour period, in essence.
I mean, this is not a new problem for South Africa. I feel like I've been hearing about load shedding for years. How long have people been dealing with this?
Absolutely. So this is the 16th year that we've been dealing with this. Yes, there have been brief periods in between a couple of years where we didn't really experience it. But for the most part, it's been 16 years of rolling blackouts in South Africa.
So what exactly is the source of the problem? Is it the electric grid or overall energy infrastructure in South Africa?
It's quite a few things, but let me chalk it up to a leadership problem with the utility as well as the ministry that has to have oversight over that utility. You then also have financial challenges at the utility where they're basically technically insolvent and they require huge tariff increases in order to get to what we call a cost reflective tariff. Over and above that, they sit with a lot of debt as a result of a capital build program that was embarked on in 2010 that is still giving us issues even now. But one of the biggest issues that we're sitting with Eskom, which is the state utility, is that despite about 51,000 megawatts of installed capacity and demand just being over 28,000 megawatts on any given day, despite that excess capacity, there's a lot of the fleet which is off due to breakdowns, largely as a result of not doing reliability maintenance over the last couple of years.
I gather there's also, you kind of alluded to this, a political aspect to this. The ruling ANC party clearly knows about the problem. Why aren't they dealing with it?
Absolutely. So, you know, if you look at the origins of where we started with this. In 1997, the then CEO of Eskom went to Parliament and told them that if they don't do anything about getting new capacity on board, we were going to end up in a situation of rolling blackouts. And the government of the day did absolutely nothing. Fast forward to 2007, and we started experiencing load shedding. And subsequently, then the government then said, let's work on a capacity program, on a new build program. And they started working on this, but simultaneously lining their own pockets. And through corrupt activities, corrupt contracts, stuff that is being ventilated now in various courts. And I think even in 2015, some of these things were being ventilated by the SEC in the US. So some of these contractors, global contractors, and the issues are playing themselves out in court as we speak. But most of this was aided and abetted by the ruling party, the ANC.
Wow. Well, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa just canceled his trip to Davos and the World Economic Forum to deal with this. I mean, he just evaded possible impeachment from the Farmgate crisis and now back to the load shedding crisis. How is his government handling the criticism?
Well, they seem to not be paying much attention to it. The president has on numerous occasions cancelled numerous trips to come back into the country. Just last September, he was supposed to attend a meeting with the UN General Assembly, and he cancelled because there was stage 6 at the time. Well, he came back, there was, you know, meetings, and he promised that there'd be reforms and there'd be changes 4 months later, and not much has actually changed.
So what do you see as any possible solutions right now? What can be done in the short term to bring relief to the many people in South Africa who are losing electrical power up to 10 hours a day?
from now to the next 24 months, they need to work on a reliability maintenance program. So they need to say, these are the power stations that are still viable to actually work. And we're going to run a maintenance program on these particular units, break open, see what has to be done, what has to be procured. That is the only immediate solution Eskom has to this crisis.
Lungile Mashile is an energy analyst in South Africa and lecturer at the University of Johannesburg. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In Iran, it is dangerous and illegal to be gay. Many in the queer community escape to Turkey and apply for asylum in a third country. They often keep a low profile in Turkey, but the uprising in Iran has changed that. From Istanbul, journalist Fariba Nawa has a story of one person's experience coming of age queer in Iran and how it's led to a life of activism.
Mikhail Alizadeh ekes out a living belly dancing at Istanbul's restaurants and clubs. She goes by Leo and is a professional dancer and dance teacher. She's also an Instagram influencer with nearly 500,000 followers. But during the day, you may find her in an ethnic Iranian outfit with a loudspeaker at protests against the Iranian regime. She's one of the few Iranian activists here who shares her name and talks openly to the media. Alizadeh says she's protesting in support of many Iranians, including transgender and LGBTQ people. And the crowd cheers her on. Alizadeh says she's not generally political, but the protests inside Iran have inspired her to take a stand and confront her fear of the regime. The 33-year-old is waiting to be resettled in the West. Alizadeh's story gives a window into how the Iranian regime has dealt with its queer community. Alizadeh says, I was born as a girl with the name Fatima Alizadeh. In 2012, I changed my gender and got an ID and passport with my current name. She wants to share her birth name as part of her journey. Her life has taken many turns because of the very binary system which she was born into. Iranian doctors say Iran is second to Thailand for the number of gender reassignment surgeries in the world, going back to the 1980s. Mental health specialists and doctors have to approve people who want to change their gender. The intention is to help the trans community, says Mustafa Sari Elmaz from Civil Rights Defenders.
According to some Islamic understanding, the bodies of people are created by angels, and the heart and the mind is created by God. So God can never do wrong. But angels, they're gods, so they can do some wrongdoings. So to match people's, you know, mindset and bodies, transsexuality is, or like, can be accepted, but homosexuality cannot.
But the surgery has become common enough. It's not just trans people doing it, but gays and lesbians too.
So many people are kind of like forced to take the reassignment surgeries for them only to, you know, stay in the country so that they can have a life. But of course, it's not a like really good life.
Yeah, it's kind of like forcing them into a heterosexual life in a way, right? Like, that's the idea. Is that,
In order to live openly, Alizadeh says many are being forced into this surgery. Alizadeh says several of her friends who had the surgery killed themselves afterwards. One of the reasons she's protesting is so the queer community in Iran can have more options. The government says you have two paths, Alizadeh says. You don't have the permission for other options. You're either a man or a woman. What do you mean you're gay or lesbian or bisexual? That has no meaning. When she was 15, her parents were going to marry her off to a 37-year-old, but Alizadeh resisted and married a 17-year-old boy instead. I became so bold that I took my boyfriend's hand and took him to my parents and said, if I have to marry at this age, I want to marry someone I choose, Alizadeh says. But she says her marriage was abusive and she eventually divorced. Alizadeh started a secret dance studio in Mashhad, a conservative city in eastern Iran. She dressed in loose pants, shirts, and a cap because she felt like a boy. Then she realized she's attracted to women and began dating them. When I decided to change my gender was when I wanted to have a proper sexual relationship with my girlfriend. And I wasn't a lesbian, Alizadeh says. The gender change process took over a year. She paid for a mastectomy, hysterectomy, and took hormones. Alizadeh says she doesn't regret the surgery because it allowed her to live both as a boy and a girl. While her parents approved of the gender change, the prejudice and abuse continued, this time from her girlfriend's family. The regime eventually shut down her dance studio. It's illegal for men and women to dance together. She was also receiving anonymous threats on her phone, Alizadeh says. At that time, I was crushed from every angle because of how much I had been beaten down by the Islamic regime, she says. So 8 years ago, Alizadeh fled to Turkey and applied for asylum. Then she fell in love with a man and came to some realizations. They eventually broke up, but Alizadeh found her path. I had surgery to have breasts again and told myself that I'm gender fluid and will live in the body of a woman and be a boy or a girl or neither, and it's nobody's business, Alizadeh says. She met her current husband, Bahadur Shafaqatian, 3 years ago, and they live with their three cats on the outskirts of Istanbul. She can't marry Shafaqatian legally in Turkey because Alizadeh is male on her passport, and same-sex marriage isn't recognized in Turkey. Alizadeh will continue to attend protests in hopes that the Iranian regime will fall. She says, I would love to return to my country with freedom in Tehran and open a dance studio and academy. But for now, Alizadeh lives in limbo as a refugee, doing all that she can to bring change to Iran. For the world, I'm Fariba Nawa in Istanbul.
On the next edition of the show, experts say we are seeing the largest single wave of people leaving Cuba in the history of Cuban migration since even before the revolution. Tomorrow on The World, we hear from Cubans about why they decided to leave now. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we will see you right back here tomorrow.